Hello and welcome to Power of 10, a show about design operating at many levels of Zoom, from thoughtful detail through to transformation in organizations, society and the world. My name is Andy Pollain. I'm a design leadership coach, service design and innovation consultant, educator and writer. My guests today are Johan Blomqvist, assistant professor in design at IDEA in Linköping University in Sweden. I'm pretty sure I pronounced that wrong. And Stefan Homlid, professor in design at IDEA, also at the same university in Sweden. And together with Simon Clatworthy, who's not with us today, he's the professor in design at the Oslo School of Architecture and Design in Norway. They are the authors of the new book called The Materials of Service Design. Johan and Stefan, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So the book is called The Materials of Service Design, and it is a sort of recognition, I guess, of in other, traditionally in design, you have things like materials libraries and you have, or pattern libraries. You have things that you can kind of recognize the different types of design. Why did you feel the need to write the book?
I think we felt like it was time, maybe even a bit over time to write this kind of book, since the material that we, well, me and Stefan think a lot about and work a little bit with, and service design practitioners work with daily, is not very well understood, I think, or explored. And we have been thinking about this and struggling with the issue of what the service design material actually is for a long time. And before this book, I think a lot of what we know about the material comes from other disciplines, such as service marketing or service management, for instance. And it has been useful for us to think about how to understand service from that perspective, what it means to co-create value, or what it means to work with resource integration and things like that, and what that means for design. But it's time, I think, for design to explore the material and think about what the material actually is and what it consists of. And in the process of writing this book, I think we discovered that it's much more complex. It's much more rich in terms of different types of materials, different perspectives on the material than we anticipated. So, yeah, I think it was overdue for this book.
Yeah. You know, service design is one of those things that is, at least this was one of the things, I say traditionally, we've written about it too, is, you know, we often talk about it being intangible, right? That the experience of a service or the value of a service is about the interaction between people. And so I'm interested in your use of the word materials even. So, you know, when you were doing this, you started to make a kind of taxonomy, you started to make some kind of categorization of different types of things. And it sort of forms a section of the book. And maybe you could talk about that a little bit, actually, of what those sections are. But also, was that immediately obvious of how to categorize this? Because I would imagine that was a thing you must have thought and discussed a lot.
Yeah. I mean, let me first say something about material and the intangible, tangible thing. And I'll pass on to you, Juan, to talk about this, all the nerdiness of categorizing and thinking about how do they actually fit together, all of these different ways of thinking about materials here. So one thing that we wanted to do was both to talk about service as a material, but also about the materials that service designers use in their practice. And as you said, there's a lot of thinking that this service design thing is about intangibles, about the material. And that's, of course, not untrue. But everything also needs to be in the world, which means that it also becomes material, even though maybe not in the sense that it becomes a physical thing that we can grasp with our fingers necessarily. But everything actually exists in the world, which makes it material in some sense. So that was something that kind of also developed during our writing and talking about these materials of service design that, well, they all of them are both intangible and tangible. It's not that they are either or, they're both at the same time. And that's also something that maybe is very prevalent in service design, while it's less prevalent maybe in other disciplines of design. But that also caused a lot of discussions, let's call it that, right? And thinking in when we were writing, because we also agreed when we started to writing the book that we don't have to agree about everything.
Yeah.
We just have to agree that this is an important book to write, and we may come with very different perspectives and ideas on what this can be, should be, have been. And that's what we want to do. We want to make that book happen. And then we had all those materials and the categorizing work that needed to be done suddenly.
So I've put on screen here briefly because I highlighted the content before. So Johan, you were going to talk about how those discussions resolved into... and when you say discussions, are we talking like there was like strong debate around this and arguments in a good sense, robust editorial debate, or was it like we're just trying to get our heads around this?
No, I mean, for the categorization, I think we just agreed, like Stefan said, that we won't be able to agree fully on any categorization. And so I'm not exactly, you know, that the strong words came in other situations, I think. But the categorization was interesting. So it's the third part of the book where we sort of take all the material contributions from other authors. So there were a lot of people that contributed to the book. Yeah. And their chapters sort of form this material library that we are starting with this book. And we felt like we can't just, you know, include the material library and not say something about what the materials have in common, or, you know, ways in which you can structure them or analyze them. So we decided to do some attempts at categorizing the materials. And I think we quite quickly realized that we couldn't agree. And that meant that we tried, and I don't know really why we decided to do that, but we actually included in the book our failed attempts at categorizing the materials. Not failed necessarily, because each categorization says something about the materials. So we have a viewpoint from the service marketing field, for instance. Yeah. So how could you categorize the materials from that point of view? How can you categorize the materials from a more design practice point of view? So that's another, like how the materials relate to each other as part of design. That's another categorization that we attempted to do. And the one we sort of end up with, which is not to say that, you know, everyone agrees that that's the best one or anything like that. I think its main benefit is that it's very like small and easy to understand and grasp. So that sort of divides the material into traditional materials. So some materials are more traditional in some sense. And of course, there's a lot of debate about whether or not material can be considered traditional and what that means to be traditional. But we say that a traditional material is one that you can work on alone, and you don't need to include others in giving form and shaping this material. Then we consider it more of a traditional material.
Can you give me some examples of that?
Yes, I can. So we have touch points, for instance, in the way that we describe touch points in the book, or the chapter on the material description of touch point, for instance.
Yeah, so just to add something there is also that the thing with the categorization we ended up with, which is these three endpoints on spectrum, in some sense, is that they also work generatively. So the first categorization we did with that, or the one that related to service, the traditional service fields, we felt that the materials got locked in, and it didn't really give the possibility to think outside and beyond what is already there. So one thing that this final categorization we did made possible was to actually work generatively with figuring out what could be a new material that we should work with, and how can we think about something that we're working on as a material, and okay. How can we develop a material into so a traditional material like then touch points, if we want to make it more like a co-design material, what then do we need to do?
Okay. So right now I would be, if I was listening to this, dear audience, I would be thinking, well, that's all very well. It's all sounding kind of abstract to me. So let's get kind of nuts and bolts around it. Because you use the word materials, right? There's definitely an expectation, I think, that you can then describe these things. They have certain qualities, you know, they have certain affordances and so forth. So let's start with the touch point ones. And for those of people, you know, I assume there's quite a lot of service design people listening, but describe to people who may not understand even that word, what you consider a touch point as actual materials.
Yes. So the thing is, this chapter was written by one of the contributors of the book. So I would prefer if the author of that chapter could also explain the material. So that's another thing that we noticed during the writing this book, that a lot of people that contributed to the book, they're really passionate about their material, and they know a lot about the material. They worked with the material, they can explain the material, and they have a firm grasp of what they mean by, you know, touch point, for instance, or clay, or behavior, or any other material that you can find. There's a lot of materials in the book. And yeah, so I don't want to intrude on their area, the explanation of touch point. I would rather we sort of collect these materials and make them available to people so that everyone can see them and judge for themselves if they think it's a material that they work with and they understand why it's a material, for instance, and how it's worked into a more finished form as part of design process. So,
well, I'll give my version then in that case. So for me, I always talk about touch points as something that you can see, sense, basically see, smell, touch, and interact with, right? So it's usually a thing that actually has some kind of tangibility in the world. In that way, you know, what might I hold in my hand? What or who might I interact with? You know, so it could be another person. And often, you know, and traditionally in sort of service blueprints and stuff, you have this idea of the line of visibility. And I've always kind of hated that because I thought, well, you know, if you ever sat next to someone in a restaurant smoking a cigar, you'll know it's not just visibility that, you know, makes a difference, right? Or you've got the table and the toilets and all those things. So, you know, there's quite a lot of other stuff in there. But in general, it's the moments of interaction. The things you're interacting with or sensing at any one point that I would consider a material. The obvious materials of touch points. But there are some other things like policy and time. I mean, policy is obviously a thing. It gets written down, but it's the enactment of policy, which is a sort of systems effect thing. And systems are another thing that would seem to be, other important materials. Time in particular is one of those things that, you know, we often talk about services unfold over time. They're different in that way from physical products because they sort of don't exist outside of unfolding over time, I would argue. How did you deal with time? There's a section on time, timing, and time-ing.
Yes. And I mean, in that sense, time, of course, there are a lot of different ways of thinking about time, right? And people in service design probably has their own way of working with time. But one of the things that we can see, and that is also in this description of time as a material, is that there are two different ways of thinking, very general ways of thinking about time, and then, which means that we approach time in different ways. It's the chronological way of thinking about time, that time passes, it's something we can measure, things happen at a certain point in time, etc., right?
Yeah.
On that chronology. And then it's the other way of thinking about time is usually called kairos, or a kairotic time, as I'm writing in the book, which much more has to do with the experience of time, something happening at an appropriate time rather than at a specific, not 1501, but rather at the time when it's needed, right?
Yeah.
And those two different ways of thinking about time, we can see in the way that service designers work. But maybe they're not necessarily so good at understanding and dealing with those two different ways of thinking about time. So if we're taking on a chronological way of thinking about time, we actually need to be really good at working with, for example, if we try to prototype waiting time, you usually don't make a prototype where you wait a week, which would be, it would be in real life, right? Maybe waiting
for
to
get a response from
a banker or whatever. So then working with time in that way, you have to, as a material, you have to actually think really, really hard. What is then the experience of waiting for a week? And how can I simulate that in a prototype? Which then introduces the chaotic way of thinking about time immediately. So this mix, and understanding this mix and how they coexist and how we can work and shape these materials, I mean, that's really, really important to see that.
I once did a talk that you probably saw about service design and talking about time, because it's such a... The perception of time is such a kind of relative thing, right? And so, as is quite well known, when they started putting dot matrix displays on bus stops and in train stations, you know, where it says, you know, the next train is in 1 minute. There's some research across London Underground of like how long a London Underground minute is, and it's not actually a minute. But it's this idea that if you know how long you have to wait, then waiting for that amount of time, even if it's a bit longer, it's kind of okay. What's really, really irritating is the not knowing, is the kind of death row aspect of kind of waiting for a bus or train, you not knowing, because what you're really calculating is, should I just walk now or walk to the next one or get a taxi or whatever, versus... waiting for this extra minute or 2 minutes. And there was also some research on how much people, what their sort of hourly rate, what they considered their hourly rate would be for waiting. I think when I read it, it was like $50 an hour or something. But there's this thing where it's to do with quality too. So if you go into McDonald's and you have to wait for ages, well, then the trade-off that you've made, which is, you know, crappy food, but you want it quickly, fails, right? Because you're getting crappy food and it takes ages to come. And whereas if you go into kind of like a Italian, especially like a slow food restaurant, and you order a risotto, and the risotto comes within sort of 5 minutes, well, you know, they've just microwaved it, right? So there's all these kind of trade-offs where sometimes you want to wait longer, because that part of it is part of the joy of the experience, is to wait. So I find kind of time sort of really interesting thing to play with and to explore. And it gets lost a lot in that sort of very process oriented way of thinking about services, I think.
Definitely. And I mean, time also, when we work with time as a material, it also gives us possibilities to work with pacing, with rhythm, other things that has to do with our experience of things that happens in time, right? The process view is all about things that are happening and not so much, not actually anything about time, just sequence. When we introduce time, both aspects of time, then we get this possibility to think about rhythm and pacing. And just a public transport example again, then in Stockholm, they experimented with, you know, as always in larger cities, buses are not always on time, given the time schedule that they have. So they tried out instead of then having when it when the clog is kind of easing up, instead of then having four buses at the same bus stop that were, you know, actually at different points in time, they started having the correct pace of the buses. So they were not allowed to drive, you know, and queue up. They were only allowed to keep the same distance in time between each other. So people knew that bus 40 will be here every 15 minutes.
Yeah.
And that has nothing to do with the schedule or anything, right? But with pace and rhythm.
Right. Okay. Nice. Nice. Okay. So they're just all sort of going around the circuit and keeping the same distance from each other.
Yeah.
So time, you know, you can kind of see how time gets lost, particularly in I would argue that one of the things that, say, digital product design in particular has kind of brought to the world is, it's inherited it from the kind of startup sort of Silicon Valley thing, which is that, you know, everything has to be, we have to move as an organization as fast as possible. You know, speed de facto equals good. And I think it then doesn't really get kind of considered that much. And then there's expectations, which I think are an important part of time. Those examples I gave before about some McDonald's versus kind of slow food restaurant, one of those things of kind of expectations versus, you know, what's the reality of it. So those are kind of abstract, but as you start to think about them, you can start to break them down and start to kind of think about how you might consider them. Was this the sort of idea or the intent of the book that you were, you know, as you start to pull these things apart and examine them perhaps more closely than they have been before, that you would then start to actually see things you hadn't considered to be materials, to be things you can actually play with, experiment with, design with?
Yeah, to some extent. I mean, it's been a very involved process with all the materials. So we started actually with material pitches, and we asked people to pitch, you know, the most important or one of the most important materials in a short format for first. And we wrote a few ourselves as well. And then we had a symposium, and that symposium included a lot of discussion about materiality and materials. And we gave some feedback to all the material authors. And after that, we started a process of reviewing the suggestions for materials. So, and one of the things that we definitely wanted people to think about and make sure that they could describe about their material was, you know, what is the role of this material in design? How is it shaped into a more finished form? What does that process look like? To, you know, give people a sense of what they consider the material to be and that process of using the material as part of design. So, yeah, and I mean, like I said, we've discovered a lot of materials, but also aspects, elements of the materials that we hadn't previously thought about. So from that point of view, it's been a really interesting journey.
Were there any surprises of things that people pitched and came up with, but things that you hadn't yourselves thought of as a material of service design?
Yeah, I mean, one of the authors suggested conversations as a material.
Yeah, I saw that.
Yeah, I hadn't been thinking about conversations as a material to form. You know, when talking about it, it becomes really obvious that, yeah, this is one of those super important materials in service designing. That is, and probably in many different, not necessarily only in service designing, but definitely in service design.
In general. That was Jonathan, or is it Jonathan? It's probably Jonathan, is it Rom?
Jonathan Rom.
Yeah. And Johan, you did behaviors.
Yes.
You talked about it. Tell us about behaviors as a material.
As you know, behaviors are difficult to design directly. So it's interesting, I think, from this feedback point of view. So feedback is a theme of ours in the book, I guess. We talk a lot about feedback and how feedback, what it looks like. And we know some from behavioral psychology about what it means to design for behaviors. what we can do to influence behaviors, the tools that we have available to us. We have choice architecture as one of the things that we can play around with as designers and both use and misuse, right? So yeah, it's a difficult material to pinpoint. And I think the format, like it's almost worth writing a whole book, I think, about that specifically. And of course, there has been books written about behavioral design. So it's a big topic. And I chose to write about some aspects of behavior. And I tried to focus as much as possible on, you know, what has been done to influence behaviors or to get specific behaviors to appear or in be able to influence in a positive way how people behave in different situations, I guess.
Yeah. It's kind of pretty contentious, this though, as well, as an idea, right? Because of obviously, definitely. You know, part of it is, first of all, there's a school of thought which says you can't design behaviors, you know, people do what they do. Which is obviously not true, because we know there's all sorts of things that nudge our behavior, either intentionally or unintentionally. But then, you know, the other aspect is, who's to say what the better behavior is? And I think this is a trap that certainly a lot of my students fall into. I think it's very kind of good-willed, but it's, I want people to be engaging in the political process more. People should be more sustainable in their behavior. And there's a lot of people should be X, Y, and Z. But who is the kind of arbiter of that? Did you manage to kind of navigate that at all when you were looking into this?
I think I steered clear of it as much as I could, actually. So I took the easy way out there. No, yeah, but I think one of the things that is very important in relation to that is this idea of feedback, actually, that, you know, knowing the material and knowing how the material feeds back or how the material reacts to whatever you're doing and the time spans of that. I mean, that's a whole thing that we could open up even more, I think, in the book, that like understanding your material, regardless if you're a carpenter or if you're, you know, if you're someone who paints or play the piano or whatever it is, like there's always an understanding of what you're creating and how that feeds back. And you're training yourself in being able to predict the change that you're inflicting or imposing or, you know, that comes with whatever you're doing.
Yeah.
And I think that's like part of what we also try to do with the book and in relation to behaviors, but also in relation to a lot of other materials. I mean, some people say that you can't design service. And I guess some of us say that you can't, some of the authors might say that. So this idea of feedback, like that's one way to understand the materials and think about, you know, when does material feedback, like when do you get talkback from the material? And in terms of behavior, it could be months or years after you do something that you actually see a change in behavior. Or, you know, if it's about clicking the right thing on a website, if you want to force people to do something, for instance, you can see it immediately because you can just measure that, okay, this or that many people actually now click this way. So, and yeah, figuring out how those things, like the things that you do, how that relates to how people behave and things like that, that's really difficult. And I don't think you can read about that. It's something you have to test and try and learn about this. And I mean, when writing the book and thinking about feedback and thinking about service, it was really interesting to think about how the materials influence each other, like how conversations then influence behavior, or how behavior influences thinking. Yeah. Thinking is another material that we have in the book. But also understand these feedback loops and how they can sort of interact with each other, but also to be able to figure out, like, what can I do for this service? Like, how can I understand the current behavior in this service? And what does that mean for the feedback that I'm going to get? Like, is there a threat of layoffs in this service that I'm entering into and I'm trying to change? Like, how can I approach this material? And that you have to develop sensibilities for different types of situations. And I mean, understanding humans and understanding how they might be how they might respond to your actions as a designer. I think that's really, really interesting.
And non-humans, right? I know there's a section on data, and there you get the sort of ethics gets touched on. I can't remember if there is a section on AI, is there? As a sort of, as a material?
Not directly.
Would you have, if you were to write it now? Because when did it come out? It's been out for how long now, roughly, the book?
Since December last year.
Since December, right. And so obviously the writing time, and it takes a while from their final manuscript. Mm.
But AI has been around since 59, you know?
So it has been around for a long time. Was that a conscious decision not to include that, or did no one pitch that idea, or was it, you know?
No, it wasn't pitched.
I say it now because there's obviously been, talking of conversations, there's obviously been quite a few cases of particularly chatbots, right? Just kind of, they just get kind of launched into a customer service offering, right? And cause kind of havoc in some respects, or at least, you know, if not havoc, then things go wrong. But actually, in some cases, real actual problems.
Yeah. So I think, I mean, one way of thinking about it is with the one of those frameworks we have in the book with traditionally designed materials, catalyst materials, and co-design materials, right? So when we think about AI as being part of a final service, in what ways can we form what it does in that service? And is it then a traditionally designed material, or is it a co-design material? And how, if we view it as a co-design material, in that situation, because I mean, in my view, the final design of a service is always done in the situation. So we prepare stuff that will be used for that final touch of design in the end, right?
So if
you then view AI as part of that, as a co-design material, then what do we need to do? Or if you view it as a catalyst material, as something that will, in the organization, help the people who tries to understand what they're doing, helps them drive change or become better in service delivery, not delivering lousy food, you know, with a waiting time of an hour. So I think this little framework we have is really, really important when we think about what it means when we say that something could be a material of service design. Because we have to make a bit of a bit of analytic thinking on, if I view this as a traditional design material, let's say AI, then it's actually something that I believe I can form. And then my actions as a designer, as a person who tries to form that, will be of a certain kind. But if I view it as a co-design material, then my ways of working with it will be totally different.
Yeah.
And that goes for all those materials, right? So behavior. Is it something we try to design directly and form very, very much?
And sort of shape in a sort of authorial way, do you mean?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Or is it the catalyst material? Behavior is something that we need to understand, and we can view it as a material that will help us do other things.
Yeah. So, you know, it's one thing to put a book like this together, you know, and you've got all these collections, and there's a lot of thought and thinking around service design. What do you hope people will do with what you've come up with here, and maybe apply it to their work?
Yeah, this is a tricky one, actually. You'd think that we had a better idea about how people will use it, but we talked about this, I mean, before we started writing the book, I guess, or when we just got started with it, that we wanted to write, we've been thinking about this for a long time, and we wanted to write a book about this because it's really interesting to us. And I think that we said, or one thing that we said at least, that stuck with me was that, you know, we're service design nerds. Let's write a book for service design nerds who might also find this interesting. And I think that is what we did. But I think, of course, you don't have to know a lot about service design, I think, to read the book and, you know, have it mean something for you. I think definitely it can help you expand your idea about design, what design can be, and what you can work with and for in design. I think it can be really valuable for teachers of design, since they might be able to think about using, for instance, the categorization that we have suggested, what kinds of designing they need to teach and think about in their curricula and things like that when they develop things like that. Yeah. So I think there are many recipients, potential recipients at least of the book.
That's definitely, I can imagine. I mean, it's stimulated some thinking for me for teaching, sure.
I mean, it also gives an individual designer the possibility to think about what kind of designer am I? What kinds of materials am I confident working with? Mm. How do I want to develop? Maybe also seeing new ways of thinking about materials that you have been working with for a long time. And also for companies, right? What kind of a company are we? Are we a company that are working with co-design mainly? Then how do we talk about these traditional design materials, and how do we make sure that we, in cases when we need that, have the capacity and competence to work with that?
Yeah,
I talked about that before, right? It's generative in that sense. It gives the possibility to think about, where am I? Where do I want to go? What kind of design practitioner am I? What kind of design practices do we make possible?
Yeah.
When we talk about the book with practitioners, or when I talk about the book with practitioners, a lot of times they have suggestions for materials that they're like passionate about, that they want. Oh, you should have this material in the book. It's so important. And they also recognize some materials, and some materials are like provocative to some of them. So I think there's emotional elements of why it might be fun or interesting to read the book.
I can't remember now because it was a while since I read it, but there was the aim to sort of create some kind of repository of these things. Is that still a plan or not?
Yes. So this symposia thing, it started out as a way of thinking about whether we could create a materials library for with this materials or service design kind of framing. So we're running that. It's still in under construction kind of okay. Label, right. But there is a website where we will be collecting suggestions for new materials, and also then having a process where there will be feedback loops for people that are suggesting materials to develop them and to publish them, and so they will be available for everyone in the end.
Okay, all right. I will get to that in a second, of where people can find you online. But before that, because we're coming out to time, as you know, the show is named after the Ray and Charles Eames film, Powers of Ten, and it's about the relative size of things in the universe and different levels of zoom, and it's always been the way I've found easiest to explain thinking about services, actually. So the one final question is, what one small thing is either overlooked or could be redesigned that would have an outsized effect on the world?
So my sort of focus, and what's it called when you can't let go of one thing,
passion.
Passion. Okay, yeah, passion. I was going to say I'm a monomaniac when it comes to prototyping and representing your thinking. So externalizing, going from something that's in your head to putting it out in the world somehow. And I think designers in general maybe are good at that, but I think in service design, it's been a little bit overlooked. And I think we should teach and practice a lot more, the process of materializing service, different ways of doing that, different ways of making it accessible to yourself and to others for co-design processes or for traditional design processes, then if we want to make that distinction again. And I think that would have a huge impact if we could develop the practice of externalizing service to make it easier to work with these materials.
Yeah. That's such a great answer. I love it. Stefan?
Yeah, that's always hard to follow up a great answer, right?
But no pressure.
Try. Johan, you will just give me hell tomorrow, right? But no, but one thing, I've been working with the meeting between design and the public sector for a very, very, very long time now, since 2003 somewhere. And I think one thing that is often overlooked in when working with that meeting with between design and public sector is how zooming out is done.
Mm.
So zooming out from the specific, you know, meeting with the doctors or whatever, the zooming out is usually done through the service, and you think that it's a service, but it's actually not, right? It's actually the materialization of the societal contract,
mm-hmm.
or the right you have. And that, of course, looks different in different, you know, in different political systems, etc. But it's still the fact that if it's public sector, it's not a service. So I usually say that public precedes service in public service, right?
Yeah.
And that's something. So zooming out to the service world is kind of maybe not the thing we should do, but zooming out into the public world is probably the more. From my point of view, at least, the one that is overlooked.
Good. Thank you very much. Another great answer. So I made a little URL for the book on with my, because of the actual publisher's one's very long. So if you go to pln.me, that's kind of pln.me, /materials-of-SD, you will find a link to the publisher's website for the book. Where can people find you both online? I'll put them in the show notes.
So I'm so old, so I'm mainly on LinkedIn and of course on the university and on Scholar, right? That's my slow social media kind of place.
Okay.
I can be found on that bird platform. I never do anything there anymore, but that's another question.
Are you on Mastodon? You are,
aren't
you?
No.
Oh, I thought you were. Okay, get on there.
I probably have an account, right? But I'm not on.
Okay, all right. How about you, Johan?
Yeah, very similar for me. ResearchGate, also, if you're a researcher, that's where you can find the things that I do. I think I update most manually, update my publications and stuff like that on ResearchGate. But otherwise, it's LinkedIn or Scholar, I guess. Yeah. Or the university website, yeah.
Okay, I'll put all the links in the show notes. Thank you so much for both being my guests on Power of 10.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You have been watching and listening to Power of 10. You can find more about the show on pelain.com, where you can also check out my leadership coaching practice, online courses, sign up for my irregular use newsletter, Doctor's Note, and more thoughts and stuff around service design too. If you have any thoughts, then you can put them in the comments below on YouTube or get in touch. You will find me as @apolain on pkm.social. On Mastodon, you'll find me on LinkedIn and obviously my website. And all those links will be in the show notes too. Thanks for listening and watching, and I'll see you next time.